At the consent calendar, first we have PCR 36-25, resolution relative to bids. This is finance, Councilman Lattiser.
Move favorable action on PCR 36-25.
For action, Councilman Lattiser.
Move favorable action on PCR 36-25.
Seconded by Councilman Foley.
Thank you. Item number one, 2025-085, found on page one, telephony services. Item two, 2025-415, gray shift, gray key cell phone. Number three, 2026-010, pace 9 munis. Number four, 2026-009, reaccreditation services for police department. Five, 2025-413, magnet axiom. Number six, 2026-008, police licensing and advertising. Number seven, 2025-375, face paint artist. Item number eight, 2025-376, balloon twister artist. And I do have a question for legal counsel. On item 2025-375, face paint artist, there was a typo in their position paper. We did disclose it on the council floor. Is that something that we should set aside and do a PCR on, or is that clarification adequate?
The resolution itself, the PCR is correct, and we'll have the record did reflect that typo, so the department can just submit the background documents that support that, but we don't need to change the resolution itself.
Okay, just wanted to be sure we're in safe grounds on that. And that takes care of that, Council President.
So that concludes the consent calendar. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Move favorable action on.
Seconded by Councilman Foley. Clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Sinapi?
Yes.
Mr. DeLuise?
Yes.
Mr. Foley?
Yes.
Mr. Gephardt?
Yes.
Mr. Kirby?
Yes.
Mr. Lattiser?
Yes.
Mr. Muto?
Yes.
Mr. Ricks?
Yes.
Next is unfinished business. First, we have PCR 2525, a resolution requesting the General Assembly to amend chapters 50 and 53 of the local acts and resolves of 2022 regarding the issuance of indebtedness for two new high schools and school facilities to expand the permitted use of bond premium. This is intergovernmental. So, Councilman Gephardt.
Withdrawn per request of the sponsor.
So for action, Councilman Gephardt.
Move to withdraw.
Seconded by Councilman Lattiser. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Sinapi?
Yes.
Mr. DeLuise?
Yes.
Mr. Foley?
Yes.
Mr. Gephardt?
Yes.
Mr. Kirby?
Yes.
Mr. Lattiser?
Yes.
Mr. Muto?
Yes.
Mr. Ricks?
Yes.
8 yes to withdraw.
Next, we have new business, PCR 34-25, a resolution requesting the General Assembly to review and consider adopting amendments to the public records laws as presented in 2025-H5457 from Councilman Napa. So, intergovernmental, Councilman Gephardt.
Per the request of the sponsor, we recommend hold till April 21st.
Seeing no objection, so held. And next we have referral and advertising. So PCO 5-25, an order on the abandonment of a portion of Harper Street, John Harold, Barbara Harold, Karen Harold, Bruce Moore, Mary Moore, Nancy Stockard, and Jason Stockard, petitioners. That'll be for Councilman Gephardt, and then the other, Councilman Kirby, so close. The other one will be PCO 7-25, an order on the abandonment of a portion of Old Quaker Lane, Colbia Enterprises, LLC, petitioner, and that'll be Councilman Gephardt. Next, we have unanimous consent. PCO 9-25, an ordinance amending the fire department composition, age requirements for appointees, superintendent of fire alarms, mandatory retirement ages, and definitions. This is on behalf of the mayor, so the administration. Well, first, is there any objection to consideration by unanimous consent? Seeing none. Administration, I think we have Chief of Staff, Mr. Vicente.
Good evening, Bill Vicente, Chief of Staff to Mayor Picozzi. This legislation before you tonight clarifies some language, outdated language in the Code of Ordinances under Section 20, Fire Prevention and Protection. Chief McMichael is here. This legislation, to answer any specific questions, this legislation was reviewed by the city solicitor, the fire union, as well as the fire union attorney, and they had no objections to it. If you have any specific questions.
So myself, Councilman Gebhardt, because he used his little light.
Hi, Chief.
Hello.
So why, my only question, well, I guess my only question for right now is, why is this coming to us in this manner under unanimous consent?
I asked it to be docketed, and that's how it ended up getting docketed.
It was a light meeting. Solicitor thought it was best if we can get it on here, why not?
Okay. That's all I got.
Councilman Lattiser.
Councilman Gebhardt must have peeked at my notes. But that's okay. That was one of my questions. First off, we need to amend this to show it's PCO 9-25 sub A. This is the second go round at this. Well, it is coming to us as a sub A, right? It was in our binder originally, and then we received new language on it. So would it be a sub A or not?
It is not. The language that went live on Thursday was the official language.
That's
so
fair. Okay.
It is in its proper form.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that, Councilman Gebhardt. So, Chief, that was one of my concerns as well. You know, what was the big whoop-de-doo about this? And, you know, why did it have to get put on unanimous consent? And that just starts triggering a whole other list of questions. I did have an opportunity to speak with the chief earlier. He addressed most of those questions, but I would like him to speak into the record what we did have for a conversation. The first one was already answered. The second one is why is this change needed? Why didn't it go before a committee? That question has already been answered. And who does this directly impact? And quite frankly, my concern was, is it something that is a self-serving interest? And why now do these changes necessary? So, Chief, earlier we went through pretty much every one of them. And would you just quickly go through that so everyone is clear on why these are coming about?
Certainly. Peter McMichael, Fire Chief. So the first one, 2042 composition merely updates the language, removes the language of Bureau of Fire, which no longer exists. It is now the Board of Public Safety, so it institutes that language, removing the last paragraph, the last sentence, which removes the various types of ranks and simply leaves it up to the Board of Public Safety to determine the ranks that will be deemed appropriate from time to time. And of course, this is also subject to the collective bargaining agreement. Section 2050, age and residency requirement for appointees is changed to read age requirements for applicants. What we did was removed the must be a resident and registered voter of the city at time of appointment. That no longer is legal. So we removed that language and we updated the ages instead of the ages of being for an applicant for the position of the fire department from being 21 and shall not have passed his or her 30th birthday. We changed that to 18 and shall not have passed his or her 35th birthday. So I'm not aware of any fire department having 21 as an age of application. 18 is consistent with the other communities are doing around us, and 35 at the high end of that allows a applicant to fulfill their pension obligation and retire with a normal regular pension after 25 years of employment. 2058 updates a position which was superintendent of fire alarm, and it reflects the current collective bargaining language, which is now deputy chief of communications. 2118 mandatory retirement changes that language to reflect current state law, which we removed the certain ranks in there and put any member who holds the rank of battalion chief or higher. That covers all of the ranks that are affected by this, and they retire at the end of the calendar year after his or her 60th birthday or 65th birthday if applicable, and that is reflective of state law. And then under definitions, under employee, the language stated employee means any employee of the city's fire department who is or has been represented by the union for collective bargaining purposes. At some point, I believe it was in 2007, language was changed. It was Ordinance 2043, appointments of officers to be made from the ranks of the fire department. That language had some changes made to it where it was just other than chief of department, so that the chief of department could be hired from outside the ranks of the Warwick Fire Department. So for the definition of employee, we made that definition reflect that ordinance where it says the employee was represented by the union for collective bargaining purposes or is or has been a sworn member. And that makes that employee definition cover everybody in the fire department. Yes.
Why is those three words or has been, why is that significant in this?
Or is or has been, I would, right. I would defer to the city solicitor on that. Unfortunately, he's not present this evening, but this language was provided to the solicitor and also reviewed by the union attorney also to make sure we weren't violating any collective bargaining agreement.
So I guess my question is, or concern is, it says an employee means any employee, yada, 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 for collective bargaining purposes, or is or has been. So, or has been a sworn member, that would insinuate to me that there may be some rationale or reason for bringing, and I don't mean it the way it's going to sound, a has-been employee back to the front lines. For what reason? I don't understand what that is, why that would be. Why would a former non-employee all of a sudden be construed as now an employee? For what purpose?
There is no purpose. A former employee would not be able to come back as a employee in that capacity again. There is no one who would be under that category.
Chief, perhaps, chief of staff. Could you get a clarification from the solicitor on what the intent is of that sentence for the next go round? Because this is an ordinance, so we'll have another go round on this.
Yes, I believe I can. I'm not sure, but I believe this language may have been added by the fire union attorney.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. I don't know what it means, but when something is put in there for the collective bargaining purposes or is or has been a sworn member, what is the reasoning for putting in those words or has been? There's got to be some legal intent for doing that. I sure don't know what it is, but I would like to hear from the solicitor, seeing the chief said the solicitor is the one that promulgated this language. So I need to know what that means.
Okay.
Thank you.
So Councilman Ricks.
Thank you. A few questions, some of which were already touched on briefly. So the change to, and I'm looking at the first of the four pages, section 20-50. I understand that the, and correct me if I'm wrong, under state law, we're no longer allowed to include a residency requirement, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Under state law, are we still allowed to have the minimum age requirement of 21, or under state law, do we have to allow for age 18, dropping that minimum age to age 18, or is this more of a policy decision to try to get more applicants?
This is a policy decision. We're facing reduced numbers of applicants. All fire departments are struggling with the hiring process, with retaining firefighters, and this would open that pool up to us to a larger pool of applicants so that we don't limit ourselves to only 21. I'm not aware of any fire department in the region that has a application age of 21 years old. It's pretty consistent across the board where they're all doing 18 years of age. And so we would be limiting ourselves to a smaller pool of applicants.
Not to try to quiz here, but generally speaking, you would say that most of the cities and the surrounding communities in Rhode Island, age 18 is the minimum as opposed to 21. Okay. So, yeah, just, you know, not trying to play any kind of gotcha here, of course. What I'm interested in is, okay, how can we make sure that we're conforming with what surrounding cities and towns are doing and being competitive? That sounds reasonable. My concern there, of course, is that when hiring earlier, and given that there are lifetime benefits here, then if we're hiring applicants at 3 years earlier, then that tends to have an additional financial impact as to at the time that they retire, three additional years of various benefits. But that also does mean more working years of younger, healthier, presumably, typically speaking. And then similarly, is it a policy or is it a state law consideration when it comes to the 35th birthday as opposed to the 30th birthday?
That would also be a policy. I'm not familiar with any state law that directly impacts that age.
Okay. Yeah, and there it's, in fact, has a better fiscal impact for the city in certain ways, but the reason I'm sure that there was the initial requirement under the existing ordinance for not greater than passing the initial tests, being an applicant before hitting age 30, is because people tend to not be in peak physical health, able to do the frontline work quite as well in their 50s as perhaps they were in their 20s or 30s. But obviously that's all part of the application process too, and trying to find the most qualified member. Councilman Lattiser already raised the question that I had regarding the definition of employee on page 3 under section 20-141. So I won't repeat that. I think that my questions as to the other aspects of this were already answered. And well, I mean, I suppose one last question at the bottom of page 3 as to normal retirement age. So there's some language added there as to having attained Social Security eligibility to be eligible for the pension benefits. Is that something where, is there any actual policy change here, or is this something where it's more just reflecting what's already part of the collective bargaining agreements?
So that would go back to the ordinance where that was changed, that allowed for an outside hire for the position of fire chief. When that was changed, the other corresponding language that also affects that that position was not changed to reflect that hiring. So when looking at that, the normal retirement age, in this case, so for tier two, 25 years of credible service, for example, if someone who was hired who was 55 years old as an outside hire for the position of fire chief has to retire by ordinance at age 65, that would allow them to put 10 years of vested service into the pension system, which would put them at 25% after 10 years. They would have to wait till they were 80 years old under the current language to be able to collect that, because they would have to wait until they had normal retirement age, or would have reached normal retirement time of 25 years. That person is prohibited from working that amount of time because of the late age in life that they were hired at. Certainly if an outside hire is made, that hire is always going to be at that later age in life. So they are not going to have the opportunity to get the 25 years of vested service in, or wait for that period of when they'll be 80 years old by making it eligible at Social Security. Making them eligible to collect that Social Security eligibility allows them to collect that at a earlier reasonable age. I'm not familiar with any system that requires or makes someone eligible at 80 years old. That would be an obstacle to attracting future applicants to that position from the outside, if that is the route that the administration chose to take.
It's on the tip of my tongue. I'm not quite remembering the term for it, because I know that there is a specific program, not workers' compensation, but a separate program when a firefighter is, say, hurt on the job. And I know that there are benefits under that particular program. And it's my understanding that in some circumstances, one can receive Social Security disability insurance at the same time as getting those particular benefits. So I know that a lot of these different benefit systems are all set up in a very careful way so as to avoid some sort of incentive for, and I'm certainly not, certainly don't want to infer or otherwise say that a person would or wouldn't do something just for the money. But at the same time, when setting up these benefit systems, it is important to make sure that the systems are set up in such a way that a person doesn't wind up making more money while being out of work and hurt than if they were actually working. So I am just curious about the interplay between all of those different systems in which here under this ordinance, it would be a matter of adding, allowing for the collection of pension benefits by definition concurrent with Social Security. So that is something where I would like to hear a little bit more from the city solicitor as well. I don't want to necessarily hold up first passage based on that, but I would certainly like to get a little bit more information presented so that we're making sure that a seemingly innocuous change in definitions here doesn't wind up changing benefit structures to have a perverse incentive.
Right. And so I think the language that you're referring to that allows for Social Security disability to be paid in the event someone is totally disabled falls under different ordinance language that references disability and a disability pension, disability benefits, ordinary disability, accidental disability. This is totally separate from that. This is an ordinary pension benefit, not disability. So that would not be affected by the Social Security disability language that you're referencing. This is a ordinary regular retirement. And in this case, at 10 years, it would be the 20%, not the full 50% after 25 years of pension contribution at the 10 year mark. Okay. It's only a 20% pension benefit.
I think I'm on the same page there. So really, I think what might clear that up is if it specified age-based Social Security eligibility. But it's something where I'd want to just make sure that that's all run by the city solicitor, see if there might possibly need to be that verbiage of age-based out of there, or if it would be unnecessary. I've just come across and otherwise heard about different litigation where things have been litigated for things that are less unclear, for lack of a better term, than this. And I don't want us to accidentally create some sort of perverse incentive here. Thank you.
So Councilman Bill Facenti, Chief of Staff. To the Chief's point, that disability pension, Social Security disability, is covered under a different ordinance. If you want me to ask the city solicitor a question, I'm going to need a little bit more specific than what you said. So can you give me a concise question?
Oh, certainly. I can follow up later if this isn't clear. But yeah, for the moment, it would be a matter of, okay, bottom of page 3.
I know where you are. It's just, I just need, yeah. Like, what do you want me to ask? Because it does say, or having attained Social Security eligibility, which is age-based. Mm-hmm. So if you're asking me to ask him about age-based Social Security, it already mentions Social Security eligibility, which is age-based.
Right. So unfortunately, it doesn't include expressly age-based Social Security eligibility. I understand that the header is under the header here is normal retirement age, but
right. No, but I'm just saying Social Security eligibility in general is age-based. You're not eligible for Social Security unless you reach a minimum age, like mine, 67 and a half.
Sometimes Social Security eligibility.
Councilman Ricks, you have 30 seconds left.
Thank you. I'll wrap it up briefly then. Oftentimes, Social Security eligibility, as a three-word phrase, is interpreted broadly to include Social Security disability insurance, also administered by the Social Security Administration.
Right, which
so we don't want any, I would suggest we don't want any lack of clarity on that, because then this would have an entirely different meaning where benefits would be compounding on top of each other instead of offsetting or in accordance with the benefit scheme as intended. That's all.
Okay, I'll see what I can come up with.
Uh,
Councilman Gebhardt.
This is just a very quick one for the chief. The fire chief, McMichael. I see very nice synergy between the entrance age being 18 years old and that the Lifesaver CTC program that we run out of Pilgrim that kids can graduate almost as a fully licensed EMT. So that's a nice pathway. I have mentioned this to the school committee chair, but I think whatever you can do to bridge that might be a boon to both, you know, recruitment, but also recruitment of, you know, kids that come from the Warwick school system. So thank you for considering that.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Councilman, I'm going there Friday to talk to that group about interview techniques and the do's and don'ts and any advice I can give them to help them out. But they are it's a great program that Pilgrim's doing over there. And I'll be there Friday to speak to them.
Councilman Gebhardt.
Nope.
Let's try again. Councilman Lattiser.
Thank you, Mr. President. Chief, I want to follow up a bit on Councilman Rix's question. On the normal retirement age, it says what it says, or having attained Social Security eligibility in Tier 1. Tier 2, it says the same thing. Do you have any members of the department that qualify under those terms right now?
No.
And how is this going to, if this were to pass, how is it going to impact the 80 rule for retirement?
I'm sorry, Councilman, how will it affect the what?
The 80 rule. As I understand it, the 80 rule, it's your time in service plus your age equals 80, which allows you to collect your maximum pension.
So that will have no impact on anyone other than a fire chief selected from outside of the department, because anyone else that is hired coming up through the ranks, they're hired, they have their full amount of time vested in the pension system by the time they reach retirement age. In fact, by the time they've reached mandatory retirement age, they've already maxed out in the system, or at least have the maximum amount that they can contribute.
And how is this going to work out where what you're apparently looking to do is tie the pension disabilities, I think you had said, tie it to Social Security?
No. So the disability, any reference to the disability pension or disability Social Security has nothing to do with what I'm bringing up here this evening. That is a totally, those are separate ordinances that are not referenced in any of the language I'm bringing before the council.
This Social Security language that you're speaking to over here, we're having attained Social Security eligibility. Does that language, and maybe the chief of staff would probably need to answer this, is that language included in any other bargaining group's contract, such as police or municipal?
This isn't, I don't believe it's included in any contract language. It's only in the ordinance.
Okay. So this should be something that would be geared specifically for the fire department.
Yes. I believe on the police side, they don't have the mandatory retirement ages that fire has. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why, but that is strictly related to fire. And I don't know on the municipal side. I don't know what the ages are for municipal.
And I understand your rationale for lowering the age from 21 to 18, but that would also mean that a firefighter could retire 3 years younger too, right?
He would still have to put the same amount of time into the system. He would still have to contribute. So somebody hired today under Tier 2 would still be required to put 25 years in, or having reached age 50, I believe is the language. And having attained the age of 50. So for Tier 2, it means 25 years of credible service, not or, it's and having attained the age of 50.
Okay, so even though he's hired at 18, he still wouldn't be able to collect a pension until he was 50.
Correct.
Got it.
Okay.
That's the questions I have for now, Mr. President. Thank you.
Solicitor.
Thank you. I was just contemplating the original question that you had, Councilman Lattiser, about the additional wording added to the definition of employee. It seems like the existing ordinance as written, and that's been around for a while, isn't fully contemplating situations. For example, a situation where a sworn member not being a member of the union. Currently, the ordinance wouldn't really read to capturing that person as it relates to their benefits and everything under this ordinance. So what it seems to be contemplating is making clear that an employee who is a sworn member is able to be treated in this manner regardless of whether or not they're part of the collective bargaining unit or not.
So why not strike that language then? Why even have it? If it doesn't mean anything, why have it? I'm concerned of the unintended meaning that this could have. You're saying it doesn't really mean anything, so why have it?
I'm saying it appears to update something that is a gap in our existing ordinance, that it's not necessarily applying things to circumstances whereby a member may not be part of the bargaining unit. So rather than the definition of employee saying it's only those that are in the bargaining unit, if they're still a sworn member, the ordinance isn't contemplating a situation of that nature. I'm not saying it actually exists either. It's providing that option.
With all due respect, I'll still fall back on my request.
This comes at the administration's request. I'm happy to work on it. I'm just merely trying to reflect on it in real time for you, that it is, it seems to be catching a gap as to how the current definition is written.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other questions or comments from members of the council? Seeing none, do we have a motion? Request for favorable action. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Councilman Muto. Any further questions or comments? Councilman Lattiser.
Thank you, Mr. President. I will vote in the affirmative on this, but I will also await the city solicitor's comments on that language. Or is or has been a sworn member, and reserve my right to reverse my support for this.
Any other questions or comments? If not, clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Sinapi?
Yes.
Mr. DeLuise?
Yes.
Mr. Foley?
Yes.
Mr. Gephardt?
Yes.
Mr. Kirby?
Yes.
Mr. Lattiser?
Yes.
Mr. Muto?
Yes.
Mr. Riggs?
Yes.
8 yes, first passage.
Next, we have PCR 37-25, a resolution requesting the General Assembly to review and consider adopting provisions of the Rhode Island Civil Rights Enforcement Act. Is there any objection to this being considered under unanimous consent? Bless you. All right, seeing none. So I'll give just a brief context. We actually, Council Solicitor.
Before we dive in onto the next item, I'm going to make sure that there's any other questions or comments from members of the public. We that item was not heard in committee.
All right. Any questions or comments, members of the public? Well, first, regarding PCO 9-25. Oh, there happened to be none. Okay. Any questions or comments regarding PCR 37-25? For members of the public. Are you a member of the public you're speaking on behalf? All right, so the context I was going to give is that we previously supported this act last session. The reason why I brought it back is because there was two substantive changes. So I didn't want to represent that the Warwick City Council supported it and misspeak if people weren't satisfied with the two substantive changes. And the short version of what the bill itself did prior was that it simply gives you the ability to enforce your rights under the Rhode Island Constitution. Currently, as a private citizen, you have no remedy for violations of your rights under the Rhode Island State Constitution. That for those who don't know, that's a very large problem, like massive problem, that's not possible to enforce right now. So we supported it last time. This time it's the same thing with the caveat of now it also applies to any governmental entity or agent, which that part is kind of standard. The other addition is that it applies to both the Rhode Island Constitution and the laws of Rhode Island. So this is in an effort to track the language of Section 1983 in its interpretation and scope analysis, because it is very well settled law and extremely limited. And without adding that additional and laws part, certain rights would get missed, such as reproductive freedom, because as those know, like that went out the window with the US Supreme Court, but Rhode Island state law enshrined it. But in order to be able to have that right enforceable, you need something like this. And also same-sex marriage. So again, this allows for those sort of things to be still enforceable. So those are the two substantive changes that I wanted to make sure people were aware of before assuming people were supportive. So with that being said, floor is open. Any questions, comments? Councilman Lattiser.
I'm not sure what the appropriate questions should be for this. So in the absence of the questions, what I'm going to request, because obviously I'm not an attorney, is some examples. And I'm looking for the first example under 42-112, purpose, as between an innocent party whose rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would like to see or have someone give me an example as to how that applies.
Which portion? So I'm clear.
From 12 through number 15, it says, as between an innocent party whose rights have been violated by acts and or omissions of a government entity as defined in this chapter and or agents thereof, it is the governmental entity and or agents therefore shall bear the cost of harm caused by such violations of rights. I think one example that was given by a member of the public was the Buttonwoods Fire District. Is that an appropriate example of this? Or you can cite me a different example.
So if the Buttonwoods Fire District fell under the definition of governmental entity as defined here, sure, it's possible. But there's other caveats to it. They have to be acting as the governmental entity. There's a whole slew of, but this, that's why this thing ends up being extremely limited in its scope, because you actually have to fit in there. So a better example would be, let's see, the mayor, what ridiculous thing. Oh, we'll use us rather than the mayor. The city council said, yeah, says no one gets to speak here except the city council under any circumstances. So a violation of First Amendment. Don't look at me that way. Under any circumstance?
We can't hear what the city solicitors, under council solicitors, saying.
So right now, if we applied our time limits differently, if you recall from when we did the rules, I said the time limit has to be the same to the public and the city council, otherwise it violates the First Amendment per the courts. So that's the federal First Amendment. So as far as any state constitutional right, state First Amendment or anything of the sort, you have no enforcement action capable. So if someone violated a right specific to the state, you just have to sit on your hands. You can't do anything. And certain state rights are different. So for instance, the Second Amendment in Rhode Island happens to be stronger. I always use that example because it's so obvious. It just says the right to bear arms shall not be abridged, and then there's a period. There's no any added caveat. So it is common that you have your own individual set of rights under the Rhode Island Constitution or under any state constitution you happen to live in. It is, I don't think it's occurs anywhere else in the country, I hope not, where you can't enforce your rights under your state constitution. That is absurd. And hopefully we are the only one like that, although it's also shameful if we're the only one. But I guess is there, you know, excuse. It's really bad. Especially now, we think about from the changing federal landscape where people have different ideas as to what your federal rights mean. And then that percolates into the courts. So what your right means at the federal level, given that it's a now rather amorphous, your federal rights might not be enough. The fact that you can enforce them, that might not actually help you, depending on how the country goes. And unfortunately, it's going in a very interesting way currently.
I'm not sure if that really made it clear, at least in my interpretation.
So as of now, the Rhode Island City League of City and Towns, so I've been watching their updates. They haven't come out against this that I've seen. Most groups are outright for this. I don't know of any that are against it. And just like last time, it was seen as kind of very benign. I think last time the league outright opposed it. I don't know of any opposition this time, though.
So on page 2, line 16, under cause of action, a government entity shall be liable for any harm caused to an aggrieved party subject to a deprivation prescribed under section yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
So that also means the city council or the town council. Or does that also include boards and commissions, the board of public safety, the board of appeals, et cetera, et cetera? Are all of those entities included in this item that I'm not totally clear on?
If it was possible already for one of those entities to be included for a liability for a violation of federal rights, then assuming that Rhode Island has the duplicative right, then yes. But it's not like you're not adding something that they weren't liable for in the first place, because they already violated somebody's rights. They already were liable under the federal constitution. This just also makes them liable under the Rhode Island constitution. And despite that, it's not usually you can't double dip. And as Councilman Ricks will tell you and Councilman Napa was here, you can't, just because you can't just start stacking on damages, it's still enough to make you whole plus whatever attorney's fees. So it's not like you're getting, oh, this statute has attorney's fees provision and this one too, so now I get double. That's not how it works.
Further down, it says, provided that neither the state of Rhode Island nor any of its political or administrative subdivisions. What is a political or administrative subdivision?
Department of Education, be an example.
And?
It could be applicable to pretty much every form of government that is under the umbrella of delegation to the state, by the state. So, for example, we're a legislative charter municipality. We're technically a subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
But departments, agencies, the quasi, the airport, et cetera, they're all governmental entities or different classes of subdivisions underneath.
And again, the key caveat is it's not like this is new stuff. So if we were already exposed under the federal constitution, so therefore we'd be exposed under the Rhode Island constitution.
So then, is it fair to say that what you're speaking to right now in these explanations, essentially it's taking state law to mirror federal law, or to update the language in the state law to bring it up to par with the federal law?
Yeah, it's to fix a colossal screw up made probably before we existed, actually definitely before we existed, where for whatever reason they did not put in the ability to enforce your own rights under the Rhode Island Constitution. Someone somewhere dropped the ball. And I believe it was within the last few years, there was a court case or one or two where it suddenly this came to light where courts were like, wait a minute. Yeah, you can't enforce those rights. And they definitively said no. And so now people are like, oh, well, we gotta fix that.
Last question is on page 3. It is line 8. This chapter, whether the relief is obtained as a result of a judgment, settlement, or the voluntary change in behavior of the governmental entity after the filing of an action. What does that mean? Or the voluntary change in behavior of the governmental entity?
So if a governmental entity was told, hey, you're violating the law.
I'm sorry?
Like if we were violating the law via our time limits, like the example I described before, so then we stopped violating the law. We said, oh, we'll fix that. So that would be a voluntary change in our behavior.
So an example would be if we, I'll use the council rules, we make a change in the council rules that somewhat runs afoul of this. That would be a voluntary change in behavior?
If it ran afoul of it? I mean, from the not version of it, yes, that's a voluntary change of behavior, but not the kind that's contemplated here.
What kind is contemplated? That word.
That clause is in regards to prevailing party. When the party violating the rights of whomever voluntarily changes their behavior to stop doing that.
I'll stand down. I'm still confused, but I'll stand down.
Yeah, and so you are under no obligation to vote yes. You are under no obligation to vote no. Don't feel pressured to do one or the other. The only caveat is we supported it before. The only two substantive changes are the ones I spoke of initially. And if it seems like a weird situation, it's because it is. It is very bizarre that this gap currently exists. So Councilor Muto?
Same thing. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm actually a little confused. If can you simplify saying who does this benefit and who does this potentially harm?
So it benefits every citizen in Rhode Island. It potentially harms any governmental entity that wishes to either continue violating someone's rights or wishes to contemplate doing so in the future. If you want to do the less severe vote at it, let's say someone innocently violates rights, that you could say it could hurt them. But usually, I mean, the kind of situation this is contemplating is typically basically the kind you see on the news where XYZ did this and now they're suing. It's not usually a situation where, hey, you're doing something you're not allowed to, please change it. And you go, oh, okay, and you change it. We're talking about people who have based on my experience, and again, Councilman Ricks, if you've had the cases, usually civil rights cases only happen when something egregious has happened. The benign stuff, when people say, please change it, it just gets changed. And you never hear about it in the news because it was a non-issue. Just people make mistakes, so they fix it when it's brought to their attention, as opposed to people who basically say, walk off, we don't care about you. So it will definitely hurt those cities and towns who want to keep grinding down citizens, which you can imagine I have no sympathy for them, including if it was us. I would have no sympathy for us if we wanted to basically put citizens under our heel. Councilman Lattiser?
Out of curiosity, has either chamber at the State House moved on this?
I don't believe it has come up for vote yet. I believe last cycle it passed one of the two. I can't recall which. I just don't recall which chamber it passed last time. But this time, I don't believe it passed one of them yet.
So it's still sitting in committee in both chambers?
I believe so. I want to say yes. That's partially why it came to us under unanimous consent, so that our voice could be heard one way or another.
Would it make sense for us to wait and see if there's movement at the General Assembly on this?
So for me, no, it wouldn't make sense, just from my perspective on the issue, but you are more than entitled to have that outlook. That's absolutely fair. Just like you're more than entitled to say you hate it. All these things are absolutely allowed.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Move favorable action.
Do we have a second? Second by Councilman Ricks. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Snappy?
Yes.
Mr. DeLuise?
Yes.
Mr. Foley?
Yes.
Mr. Gephardt?
Yes.
Mr. Kirby?
Yes.
Mr. Lattisa?
A reluctant yes.
Ms. Muto?
Yes.
Mr. Ricks?
Yes.
Eight yes. Passed.
And that's it. So first we have, you have a motion to adjourn? Councilman Gebhardt? Any opposition? Seeing none. Does anyone have anything for unanimous consent for the upcoming meeting? And seeing none, docket session, who's gonna do it? I just consider it a war between Foley and Lattiser, usually. No, Foley doesn't wanna do it. All right, Councilman Lattiser. So we're in the docket session now. So Ward 1? Ward 2.
One item. A resolution recognizing the month of April as National Arab American Heritage Month.
So Community Affairs, Ward 3. He's not here. Ward 4.
Yes. Like to make a resolution regarding council meeting schedule.
Intergovernmental, Ward 5.
Yes, I have one. It's a resolution. It's being co-sponsored by Council President Sinapi, Councilman Muto, and any other co-sponsors are more than welcome to sign on. It's a resolution to the General Assembly regarding council amendments.
Regarding charter change.
I'm sorry, charter amendments.
Intergovernmental. Councilman Muto, Ward 6. Yes. Ward 7. Ward 9. And so then I have two. On behalf of the mayor, ratification of memorandum of agreement between the City of Warwick and Local 1651, Council 94 AFSCMAAFL-CIO regarding OPEN. Their acronym needs to change. Intergovernmental. And then on behalf of the mayor, resolution to General Assembly regarding school committee composition and co-sponsored by Councilman Lattiser. And also co-sponsored by Councilman Foley, Councilman Muto, Councilman Kirby, Councilman Ricks, Councilman DeLuise.
And he did too.
Oh, and Councilman Gephardt, sorry. So everybody but Napa, because he's a bum and didn't come here.
He wasn't saying bye, he was saying co-sponsor.
All right, and that's everything. So we stand done, 8:40 p.m.